welcome to the Early Years Web Summit with me, Kathy Brodie of kathybrodie.com. In this summit, we're exploring children's personal, social and emotional development, and especially strategies for helping children in this key area of development. Today, I'm really excited to be joined by Suzanne Axelson. Suzanne has more than 20 years experience in a variety of early years settings, multilingual, Reggio Emilia, traditional Swedish settings, as well as Montessori settings. On her blog, Interaction Imagination, she shares ideas, experiences and ponderings all about working in the early years. Until recently, Suzanne worked in Sweden's first preschool with a philosophical profile, where she developed how philosophy can act as a pedagogical tool for young children. Most recently, Suzanne has been involved in the Freedom Theatre in Jenin, Palestine, in an effort to inspire a greater play focus on early childhood education in Jenin, as an advisor from Sweden, as well as on-site support, teacher training, and researching the effectiveness of this course. I'm delighted to have you here. Welcome to the summit, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. I'm absolutely thrilled that you're able to join us because I want to explore the Reggio Emilia approach with you today, and particularly how that can support young children's personal, social and emotional development.
I think the whole idea of the Reggio Emilia approach is a very social one. It's about relationships. It's about the pedagogy of listening. So by enabling children to be able to listen not only to the teacher, but to each other, and the teachers being able to listen better to the children, you establish the social emotional relationships within the whole group, with each individual child and the teacher relationship with each child and the group. And there's a focus on group learning. I like the word we, because it's not just the idea of each individual child, the me of each child, but it's also the we. It's that learning together. That learning is not a separate thing. I know in England there's this wonderful word of the unique child, and I struggle with that a little bit because I know each child has their own individual way of learning, but unique seems to separate them all off into their little own categories, while I want so much that the learning should be a community rather than individual, and that our differences gives us new perspectives that we can learn from each other, but we do that together rather than in our unique ways. So we take this uniqueness, our differences, as a strength that we can share with each other. And then it becomes like a natural part of society, a natural part of learning, instead of all these different ways of learning. Even though there is the 100 languages of Reggio Emilia, it's not saying that we have to treat each of these 100 languages separately. It's using all of these languages together and seeing them as a strength.
Right, so it's sort of stronger together rather than as separate then.
Yes, very much so. And it's typical Vygotsky, you know, to tell, you know, each child will learn from each other. They will support each other. The adult is like, they should be scaffolding their learning rather than that we are informing the children how to learn and filling them with information. The children are co-constructing their own knowledge and are very much active in this whole learning process, which means because they're doing this together, their social emotional skills are developing at the same time as they're constructing knowledge.
Yes, and that there is very much a focus on that social aspect of the personal, social and emotional development, isn't there? So whenever I see a Reggio Emilia, when I see pictures and videos of the environment that's going on, it always seems quite busy and quite purposeful. But first of all, could you give us a little bit of an overview of just a brief overview of what the Reggio Emilia approach is, and how that translates into early years practice, what you would expect to see in a setting following this philosophy?
I mean, it started at the end of the Second World War, where the women of Reggio Emilia did not want their children to just follow a dictator blindly again. They wanted their children to think critically, that there should be democracy. And they asked Malaguzzi, who was only 24 years old at the time.
Wow, really?
I know. To support them in teaching their children a way to become democratic members of society and critical thinkers. so that they wouldn't just follow blindly this dictator. He obviously was very humble in this and saying, well, I don't know how to do this, but I can learn together as the children learn. The children will teach me, and I use this as a teaching back tool. So it started there, and he basically looked at all the different kinds of research from Dewey, Piaget, Rousseau, Froebel, you name it, he's looked at it. Hawkins is one of my favorites too. And he took pieces of all of these different kinds of pedagogies and methods and pieced them together that suited the children and the setting and the context that they were in. But not just within pedagogical studies, he went in psychology and sociology. And if he was still here now, I'm quite sure that Alison Gopnik and brain research would be infiltrating his and being woven into this fabric. Yeah. He was very, very clear that this was not a method, it was an approach, that he shouldn't be writing this down, because this pedagogy should be evolving all the time, the same way that society evolves, in the same way that children evolve, so that we can't fix it and say this is a right and wrong way of doing it. We should always be piecing things together to create the right learning circumstances for the group of children and the context you're working in right now.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about the circumstances, is that the physical environment as well as how educators and practitioners work with the children?
Absolutely. There's the social environment, the physical environment, the cultural environment. The children are not just part of a school. They have their family, their home, they have their neighborhood, they have their city, they have their region, they have their country, and they're also a part of the world. And all of this influences them. So it's, you know, it's a huge part. A child is not just what they are in school. You have to take part of everything, and the context, what happens in Italy is not the same as what's happening to me here in Stockholm, which is definitely not the same as what's happening back in the UK. We all have to have our different approaches. And both in Italy and Sweden, we don't start school until much later than what you do in the UK.
Absolutely.
So we have more time to do and use these kind of approaches of not forcing reading and writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is absolutely wonderful. We do it when the children are interested. Yeah. And yeah. That really means that we can focus more energy on the social emotional welfare of the children, because we're doing things when they are ready for it, rather than when they have to do it because policy in the school says, now you have to learn to read and write and do it this way, regardless of whether the child is ready.
So really that personal, social, emotional is you're laying down those foundations, aren't you, that bedrock. Mm-hmm. And then when they do get to school or get to formal education, then they can fly, can't they, because that's all sort of laid down for them. So, I mean, that's a bit of a flavour of where it came from and the sorts of things you would expect to see in that approach. How does that vary with other pedagogies? Because you've already mentioned quite a few other people there, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners and viewers will be familiar with. So what do you think the main differences are between the pedagogies?
I think a lot of the pedagogies are methods rather than an approach.
Right.
And therefore there's quite this thing of being a right or wrong approach. This is a Montessori way of doing it, so it needs to be done this. Take out the mat. The mat should not be used as stepping stones, but as a work surface. You carry the chair like this. And I think there's a lot of good points in Montessori. Mm. I love the way that ergonomics is a very important way that carrying the chair is not just about doing it correctly. It's about supporting their backs and doing it correctly. So it's much more complex. But I personally struggled with the Montessori method, that there was a correct way of using blocks and a correct way of of using the mats, because my head was wanting to use them as stepping stones.
Yeah.
Especially when they're all dotted around, or not when they were being used as work surfaces, but at other times to be used there, but they couldn't because they were holy in that sense. And of course, I think if Maria Montessori was alive now, she would do it very differently, meeting the needs of children now. These are the needs of children 100 years ago. And I think she was revolutionary at the time.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
It's nothing about, she was amazing, and there's so much that is still incredibly relevant to today. but I think we need to build on it. And I think Reggio gives you that edge to be able to just take the parts that are relevant to yourself rather than having to follow the entire method, whether you agree with it or not.
So in that respect, it is actually a true pedagogy, isn't it? Because it is an approach, as you say, rather than having to sort of tick those boxes or meet those needs for something that you might be following. And I'm particularly thinking here of the English curriculum under the EYFS, that we feel we've got to follow that quite rigid framework in some ways. But in fact, Reggio allows you, well, it encourages you to actually go outside that box and to think about different things that the children might want to explore, and particularly in their environment as well. Could you give us a little bit of a flavour of what a Reggio Emilia environment for you would look like, what you would expect to see in there?
Now, this is something I kind of joke around a lot with, because I think there's a big focus on Reggio Emilia environments being beautiful, and everything has to be beautiful and wooden and natural. And I do not think this is the case. I think it should be put together with care, with respect for the children. But what is beautiful? Is it from an adult perspective? Is it from a child's perspective? So, you know, I kind of question that. When I look at what they have constructed with blocks as beautiful, it's sometimes, you know, I have to have a leap of imagination there to find the beauty. But I think it's being a space that is designed to create interactions between the children, between the children and the adults, between the children and the, so that they can learn together. It's a space that creates opportunities for the children to come together and learn together as well, but also opportunities to go off and explore on their own. It's a space to allow them to be competent.
Yeah.
That's in reach. They can make choices. So everything has to be considered carefully. How are you putting things on the shelves? Why these things close together? Why not these things close together? So just choices always, as a teacher, you're reflecting on, why am I making the room like this?
Yeah.
Why am I dividing it into a construction area, a writing corner, these kind of things? And why is the writing corner over on this side of the room, the construction over on this side of the room? And how do these interact with each other? Could I change the dynamics by putting them closer together or mixing them together?
So just by actually setting up your environment and thinking about where things are, you're actually changing maybe the way that children access things, the way that they make those connections. And they might even come up with some surprising connections which we've never thought of before, simply by moving the writing next to the construction area or something like that.
We found that the construction and the role play area needed to be really close together.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they wanted to mix those materials together all the time. And if we did, and we have experimented like crazy, sometimes we had the opposite ends of the building and the children would just transport everything from the construction area into the role play or vice versa, because this was, you know, little handbags are perfect for putting blocks in and things like that and all of these materials. And they could be transported. Transportation is just brilliant as it is, but it often made it hard to find where everything was at the end of the day, and sorting became tricky. So we tried to enable the children to have a space that was easy for them to manage as well, because you don't want to have... I mean, a lot of people discuss this whole idea of a messy environment, and I think mess can sometimes be a sign of play. It's not a bad thing. But when you're drawing, you prefer to draw on a blank piece of paper to get your own creativity, not always to be recycling old drawings or newspapers as you're drawing paper. And I think it's the same with play. It's fine to move into a room that shows a lot of evidence of play, that it's chaotic. You can carry on the play, but there is also that need for the room to be set up in a way that you can start a new play if you want to. Yeah. So it needs to be a combination of both.
And again, it's that thought, isn't it, that practitioners and educators need to put into it, to stand back and have a look at the environment and just say, what am I trying to achieve? And it might be, as you say, you've got to leave out the models that they've made because you want them to carry on, or you know the children would like them left. Or it might be that you make that decision that no, today we're going to start with a blank canvas and start again. Yeah.
Usually you can tell when you need to start with a blank canvas because no one's going to that table anymore.
Ah, you see, that's interesting. Right, so that moves us quite nicely on. Top tips for practitioners. What sort of things should they be looking for? Because at the moment it's sounding quite quite complicated. You've got to do a lot of reflection, a lot of thinking about. But that's a really great top tip already, that if they're not going back to the table to play with it, they're actually telling you, I've had enough of that. You need to do something else, aren't they?
Yeah, either you tidy it up and put it away and have either another invitation available or just the blank space so that they can start again and bring out their own ideas. But putting up photographs of what there was there up on the wall next to it, or creating a file next to it so they can see. Because we did this with Lego, because Lego is one of those materials that often is hard pressed and used, and there's sometimes quite a lot of competition with who gets the best pieces.
Of course.
We've taken away Lego and it was really, really good. But when we did have Lego, we would take photographs of the children's creations, and we made a book from this so the children could go back and look at it. So there wasn't this need to save it forever. Yeah. They could see that they could save it through these books. And then they often would look through these books and use them as inspiration. So the children would be inspired by someone else's creation. And if there was time, you'd just load the photograph up into a PowerPoint, get the child to describe what it was, so you just have a brief amount of text, and you could just print it out. I mean, especially when you have access to the Wi-Fi printing system, where you could be there with your laptop with the child, print it out, go collect it, and stick it in the...
And it's instant then, isn't it? Yeah. That's a really super idea. I love the idea of taking, and I think you could, that doesn't have to just be Lego. You can expand that to anything, couldn't you? Yeah, outdoor play and all sorts of different things that are going on there.
We do that with excursions and with activities and with all sorts of things about what do you remember from yesterday, and you put their things, so they can put it straight into their portfolio as well. So it makes it simpler, and the children become aware of why you are documenting. So they also become more aware of telling you, you need to take a photograph of this because I'm learning how to do this. My children became experts. You need to film this. But they knew the difference between when I had to film them and when I had to take a photograph of them as well, because they knew which was the process and which was a memory.
Wow, really?
They became experts of documenting themselves because I share the documentation process with the children rather than doing it separate.
So that must have taken time there. You must have taken time to sort of sit with the children, explain what you're doing, and taking them through that first.
Doing it all the time. I'm taking this photograph so that you can see later. And I mean, sometimes they would... draw pictures. He said, you need to take a photograph of this picture because in 6 months' time, I'm going to do the same kind of picture. I want to see how I've grown in my learning. Wow. Because they'd seen that I'd done this, because I worked with the same children for 3 years. Yeah. They also learned my learning style and teaching style. So they were able to use and exploit me to the best extent as well, and which is what Reggio is about. This is a relationship between the teacher and the child to optimize learning.
And I think that's another benefit of having children for that bit longer before they start formal schooling, because you've got that bit of extra time to build those relationships up as well, haven't you?
Even within the Swedish school system, as a class teacher will have their children for 3 years.
Oh, how super. Yeah. So as you say, they will get to know you in that time, won't they? Yeah. I think that's a great... Is that quite a standard thing then?
Standard thing. When they get older, then they'll have different teachers for different subjects, but they will have the same mentor teacher for 3 years.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's a really, really good idea. Because by the time you're in the first year, if you're just with a teacher for 1 year, you've only really just got to know them. Mm. And then you have to go through all the transitions again. Yeah. So if we've got practitioners and viewers who are watching at the moment and they're thinking, this would fit me really, really well, how would you advise somebody to start a Reggio Emilia approach in their setting? Or is it that easy?
I think yes and no. I think it's easy if you make the decision that you want to do, then yes, it's easy. You throw yourself into it. But no, it's not easy because it's not something that's instant. It's a process, and it takes many, many years, and I am still in my process. I am still learning. So it's, and I've been doing this, I'm not even going to say how many years. And it's, you've got to dare to make mistakes. You've got to dare to let go of the power. And it's not about following the child. It's about having an equal power with the child, that you are empowering the child for their own learning. Yes. I am not teaching the child. We are learning together. I am enabling their learning. Yeah. So it's a very different approach in that sense. And I see a lot of teachers that they're kind of nervous of giving up that power.
Yeah.
Because as adults, we have an enormous amount of power. And being aware of how much power you have in the room really helps that balance become more equal. I had children that 1 year seriously challenged my authority. Mm-hmm. Like they were just saying, why are you making all the decisions? And why can't we make all the decisions? And they can't, you know, children being children, they don't realize making decisions means you also have to take responsibility for these decisions.
Yeah.
And when I make decisions, I take responsibility for that. So I handed over the power to them and said, well, you're making the decisions. And they did not like the responsibility that came with it. They found it too hard work. They would much rather play than take responsibility of choosing where they were going to make sure that everyone was included. Yeah. There was one time where it just went crazy. And they all started, a couple of children started hitting each other. And I was like thinking, oh my God, what have I done? Yeah. And it was probably the scariest 10 minutes of my life because I'm thinking, now what? I've gone mad that I should not have done this. What are the parents going to say? And within this 10 minutes, the children came to me and says, you've got to take control again. You've got to tell them to stop. And I said, well, no. You said you wanted the control. This means that you need to tell them to stop.
Yeah.
And then they came up, but they're not listening to me. So we had this huge dialogue afterwards about what I had, what my control was ensuring that they were safe, that they were all able to have their voices heard by everyone, that each child was respected and valued, and that I wasn't making them do anything. I was just empowering what the children themselves wanted.
Yes, and that's a very significant difference, isn't it? That it's, and I think that's something that educators still struggle with. What am I following the children's leads, or am I actually putting my own adult agenda on what it is that we're doing here? And I think, maybe not as an extreme example, but I think that's happening every day in settings up and down the country where educators are saying, am I going to step in, or am I going to stand back? Are they going to have to sort this out, or am I going to have to step in on this? So that's but that's really interesting that you then had the dialogue afterwards with the children and explain that. And that's, for me, maybe is the Reggio Emilio approach there.
It's the dialogues. It's,
yeah,
I mean, this is why working philosophically was so empowering as well, because as you're not a leader of a dialogue, you're a facilitator of the children's dialogue. So during the actual philosophical dialogue itself, my opinions are not to be put across at all. I am not to have a hidden agenda. I'm just there to listen and to enable their thinking, to help the children connect their thinking. They were 2 years old when they started, and or the youngest child was 2 years old. And so they did this until half the group was six and they started school. And I wrote down every single dialogue we had with the children. And you can not only see their language development, you can see their idea development, you can see their social development. All of this is visible in these texts. But you also had to enforce a strict routine or rule within the dialogue that you keep on topic. You are always respectful of each other's ideas, and that just because someone thinks differently from yourself, it doesn't mean they're wrong. It means you should try and be open to that, and either you change your mind or you adapt your idea, or it makes you more sure of your own idea. And the children were amazing, and I could see how this really affected their thinking and how they applied this in their play, how they applied this in their learning, in all different kinds of situations.
So that is a true life skill you're giving them there. That's not just teaching them a lesson about, oh, these are your colours or your shapes. That's actually a proper embedded life skill that you're giving them to take on, isn't it? So how long does it take to sort of work with children? Because it's a very different way of working to what you'd expect to see in a lot of settings. How long does that take to sort of get that system going, that approach embedded?
I think you need to have a few years, really. I think you will notice changes in the beginning because it's like the honeymoon phase where you make changes, you become aware of your environment, you become aware of what you're doing, and there's all these new things that you're adopting and seeing the child as competent and trying to let go of that power. But letting go of that power is really hard. Yeah. Changing the time is different because you're giving everything much more time. While I think in many schools you have a very hard time agenda to follow, and this is, you need to do this, and you need to do this, and then we're changing this, and then this theme is happening, and then Valentine's Day is popping up. And you know, it makes it very hard to be Reggio approach because there's lots of these old traditions that keep having to be plopped in.
Yeah.
And you haven't quite got to the place where you're questioning the validity of these traditions. And I'm not saying take away traditions, because I think traditions are very important, but we should be questioning, why are we having these traditions? How are they meaningful for the children?
Yeah.
Valentine's Day, I mean, everyone notices it. All the children kind of notice it because there's hearts and balloons and pinks and reds and all sorts all over town. So instead of celebrating Valentine's Day, I would ask the children, what is love? And we'd explore love, and then we'd create a piece of artwork based on their ideas of love.
Wow. Even with very young children, you'd ask them, that's a massive question.
Yeah, but mostly it was their parents in the beginning. And so because I had this from when they were 2 until they were 6, I was able to share with the children what they said their first years. Yeah. And each year, and develop their ideas, and how they could see their own learning.
How lovely. And again, I assume that you would share that with them and sit with the books and say, look how you have developed, and so on. I think that's so respectful to do that with children rather than observe or make notes or take photos and kind of not even say to them, oh, I'm going to be doing this, or is it all right if I do this? Yeah. It feels much more respectful. And as you say, it's that co-construction, is it? That coming together of ideas. Yeah. So it's going to take a long time for practitioners to fully implement something like a Reggio approach. Mm-hmm. But if there is something that they would like to work towards, it's something that they're aiming for, what would your one top tip be for practitioners or educators who are working in the early years?
Reflection.
Oh, wow. Right. Okay. You have to unpack that a little bit.
It would be taking the time to reflect on why they're doing what they're doing, taking the time to reflect on each individual child, taking the time to reflect on their own teaching. Why am I doing this the way that I am doing it? I think without the reflection, there's no point in doing the Reggio Emilia approach. It is about reflecting, about the processes, about yourself as a teacher, about the children as the group, about the learning, about which direction the group should be doing. What is it they're doing at the moment? Is their interest about owls just about the anatomy of owls, or is it about that they're scared of owls, or is it because they're scared of the dark and owls come out at night? To work out what it is about, because then if you understand what it is the children are really interested in, what they're really wanting to know, then you can really base everything, the math, the science, the stories, and everything can come off the real interest there.
So it is going to take a little more time for practitioners to really get into what the children are thinking, and maybe the context, where that's come from, and for me, it feels like there's going to be quite a lot more standing back and watching rather than diving in and doing. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So
the idea of trying to make yourself invisible. You're the most successful in children's learning when the children can learn themselves.
Yeah. And
I'm invisible for the majority of the time. The children know I'm there and they can turn to me when they need me, and I become visible when they need me or when I need. And sometimes the need can be that I see they have a need, and sometimes the children will learn how to ask for help, because I think that is also important, asking for help. I think a lot of people go through that, children saying they have to be competent, they have to do everything themselves. And I would get the children to, it's fine to ask for help, to know when your limitations are.
Yeah.
And maybe to ask a friend for help rather than an adult, because eventually these children will be adults and you want to have a doctor in the future who is fully capable of asking his doctor colleague for advice and help with something, and not to be competent and survive on his own. Because I think I would have much more confidence in someone who can ask for help.
Absolutely. I think that's a really, really great top tip, that the children can help themselves and within the peer group. And we know, any group of children you have, you're going to have some that are more confident and competent in some areas than others. And for children to recognise that in their own peer group is really nice, isn't it? Mm. I'm just thinking that's going to probably support their emotional development as well, if somebody recognises them as being, you know, the more knowledgeable other.
Yeah. Taking care of each other. When the children fall over, I mean, I'm always there, I always see. If it's a big fall or a big hurt, I'm there, I'm on the spot. But when there's a smaller fall, instead of me rushing there and the children relying on the adults to help the child, I make sure that the children go over and ask, what do you need? How can I help you? And I've got absolutely amazing photo series of children who, they're running over, the whole group running over to a friend that's fallen over. They pick them up, they check the knees, they check how they are, they hug them, they ask them, how can I help? They move them to a bench, they sit down for a while and say, we can play again when you're ready to play. Modeling exactly the same things that I had done with them when they were younger and when they still needed adult help. But it was amazing. They could do it themselves because I believed that they could do it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I knew that they could if I gave them the space, if I made myself invisible.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a lovely example. That's so nice. And, you know, I think for me included, that I would be rushing in myself. It wouldn't occur to me to have the other children helping. So I think what a lovely scenario that is.
It's the hardest thing you do. You literally kind of putting your hands in your pockets when you're standing, or you're sitting on your hands saying, because you really, really want to go over and help, but it's like, oh, yes, definitely the first time. So you feel like you've got your heart in your throat the majority of the time, because, and then you're waiting. And sometimes they will come and say, they're bleeding, we need a plaster, and we'll go over and we'll help them. And the same with climbing frames, the children help each other rather than me lifting them on, they're lifting each other up, because they are empowered. They realise that they don't have to depend on an adult to fix their problems. Yes. They can be resourceful themselves and fix an awful lot more than what they've ever been given the time or the belief that they can do.
Yeah, and I think, again, that's another fantastic life skill, isn't it? You know, that resilience and all that sort of that goes with that package is just amazing. I just think that's... Wow, that's just, I'd love to see that piece of video as well. That sounds so cool. That sounds really good. Now, I know that you do have a blog and you have a Facebook, and your blog is Interaction Imagination. And I know I'm always on your Facebook. I follow you on Facebook, and there's always interesting. I spend a lot of time scrolling through all the discussions because there's always something going on. There's always a new picture or a new provocation on there. So some really interesting things in there. And obviously that's, you have the double whammy of both being Scandinavian and Reggio inspired. And of course, with your work in Palestine as well now, that's going to, I'm sure, start to seep through as well.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And there's some lovely pictures from Palestine on there at the moment, aren't there, from your previous visit? So. Mm. That's definitely worth going to have a look at. Suzanne, it is always a pleasure to sit and chat with you. Thank you so, so much for sharing your expertise with us today. Just loads of things to go away and think about there. So thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Early Years Web Summit.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much to our viewers and listeners today for joining us on the Early Years Web Summit about personal, social, emotional development.